Okay. Before we begin, I wanted to ask you, does anyone have any questions, any problems so far? I thought last time there were some questions. No? All right. Don't forget, you should feel free if you have anything that's troubling you with what I'm saying or something you don't understand. Please feel free to let me know. Okay. Where are we in the course so far? Last two lectures dealt with the origins of the First World War. First, in very general, broad brush terms. And then last Friday, we focused in on the immediate origins of the war during the July crisis in 1914. Today, we're going to look at the war itself. And we're interested in two great theoretical questions. One has to do with why the war persisted, why it didn't end with a compromise peace, even though it would seem that what was going on in the battlefield showed that these were two sides of approximately equal power. And that would suggest, you would think, that you should have a compromise peace, you know, just not that total victory was not a reasonable aspiration. Right? That's a fundamental question, and I'll talk in a minute about why that's a theoretical interest, really fundamental theoretical interest from the point of view of international relations scholars. The other question has to do with the kinds of policies that were pursued. It's a somewhat related thing, but we're going to focus much more on the American intervention in the First World War in April 1917, the event that proved decisive in determining the outcome of this war. And we're going to be concerned, above all, with the question of what we're to make of the kind of policy that the United States government pursued during this period, you know, under the guidance of President Woodrow Wilson. Call it a Wilsonian policy, policy based on principles and considerations of justice. It didn't like to think in terms of power. It ruled out the whole notion of a realist approach to foreign policy. I'm going to be talking a lot about realism in the course of the quarter. I'm sure most of you have taken Poli-Sci 20 or other international relations courses. You have a kind of vague sense for what realism is. It's not exactly a theory. It doesn't make precise predictions about where you're going to find. It's kind of a sensibility. It's a sense of, on the one hand, what is important in international political life, more fundamental to the realist mentality is the notion of what should be important, right? What kind of policies ought to be pursued. And the basic tenor of the realist theory is that power is, and indeed should be, of fundamental importance. It's an amoral approach. Moral considerations should not be put at the heart of policy. Considerations of justice and so on. These things should take a back seat to considerations of national interest. It's like power counts for a whole lot more than a lot of people seem to think. Right? That's the basic tenet of the realist theory. An amoral approach is the way to go. And when we come to deal with the question of the American intervention in the war, the Wilsonian policy, what we're to make of it. We're going to get at that issue, not directly, but rather indirectly by looking at the argument laid out by George Cannon in that lecture that you're going to be reading this week, Chapter 4 from his book, American Diplomacy, which is originally a series of lectures he gave, I think, 1950 or 1951, at the University of Chicago, right? Very important series of lectures in the intellectual history of American foreign policy, for reasons that I'll discuss later. Right? So we have these conceptual problems. Uh, Why is the story of the First World War of interest? Used to be, when historians dealt with these issues, they would stop with the outbreak of a conflict. Diplomatic history, history of international politics, this was about the origins of wars. Not really have much to do with the way wars ran their course. There are political questions, and there are military questions, and they're in two separate, almost watertight categories. You don't think of military issues as impacting so directly on the course of foreign policy in peacetime. They're in the deep background. And after a war breaks out, well, diplomats have failed. It's up to the generals to, take the lead in determining what the country does. Military considerations have to be in the saddle. You don't worry about politics during a war. All those sorts of views. Very common in the larger culture. There's a fundamental problem with that whole way of looking at these things. This is the core insight of the greatest theorist of military issues. The German Karl von Clausewitz, who wrote just after the Napoleonic Wars, the beginning of the 19th century. And what was Clausewitz's fundamental insight? Is that there could be no hermetic separation between military questions and political questions. Yeah. Why don't you just stick that there so the door doesn't close completely? Thanks. Thanks very much. All right? They can't be. They shouldn't be. This war, he says, has its own grammar, but not its own logic. Very key quotation from Clausewitz. The logic had to be supplied from the outside by political authority. Wars are not just fought for the sake of killing. They're not an end in themselves. They're not like a force of nature, like a hurricane or something like that, right? They're fought for political purposes. There are political goals. And the fact that there are political goals should shape the conduct of the war, should condition the conduct of the war, should determine its logic, right? And when that doesn't happen, when military considerations become the be-all and end-all and people stop thinking in political terms, then you get real problems. Right? That's the basic thrust of the Clausewitz approach to these things. The deep interconnectedness of the military and the political sides of the story. Right? Both in terms of the way the world works and the way it should work. Especially the way it should work. And these ideas were taken up by the American theorists during the nuclear age. Thomas Schelling, who's the greatest of those theorists, I mentioned him last week. The title of his most famous book, most important book, dealing with these issues was Arms and Influence. What did that title mean? It meant the connection between the military power, the ability to destroy things. And one went on the political sphere, the ability to influence the other side's political behavior. Central issue for Schelling. And the second most important American theorist of the nuclear age, Bernard Brody, who was a member of our own department and wrote his works in this very building here, he took much the same line. As a matter of fact, somewhat earlier than Schelling, building quite explicitly on Clausewitz. Brody, the great military theorist, his most famous book was called Strategy in the Missile Age, came out in 1919, began with a whole analysis of what had happened during the First World War, why the great nations of Europe failed so dramatically during the First World War. The answer was winning the war had become an end in itself. Doesn't make sense in Clausewitzian terms. You don't fight a war just to win. You fight to achieve certain political objectives. And this whole body of thought had a certain realist feel to it, because the notion was, what should those political objectives be? They should have to do with the kind of world you want to create. What's going to happen at the end of the world? Yes, from the standpoint of the Western powers, you might want to fight this war to the point where Germany is absolutely defeated. German military power is totally smashed. But then you're not going to have a balance of power in Europe anymore. Europe is going to be under the shadow of Russian power. There's not going to be any German counterweight to Russian power. And then you're going to have to deal with Russia. Do you really want to do that? Don't you want to have a balance of power? If you're basically a status quo country like Britain, France, you have this huge empire. You know, you have more than enough. Don't you want to basically create a stable peace, to stabilize a post-war status quo that will enable you to just hold on to what you have, right? In which case, shouldn't you think in balance of power terms? And if you're thinking in balance of power terms, maybe you shouldn't aim at the total defeat of Germany. Maybe you should aim at keeping German power alive as a counterweight to Russia. Besides, what are you going to do with the Germans? You're not going to wipe them out. You're not going to simply massacre them. They're going to remain there in the heart of Europe. Right? Do you want these people to be in revolt against the existing international order? Because if not, maybe you want to reach some sort of accommodation with them, some sort of reconciliation with them. Again, an argument for drawing back from an absolutist notion of what the war should be. Instead of reaching for total victory, total smashing of the Germans, maybe you should want to compromise peace. That's the thrust of Brody's arguments. If you get a chance, at some point you may want to take a look at that book, Strategy in the Missile Age, the very first chapter in the book where he talks about these things. Because in talking about how people messed up during the period of the First World War, Brody's really talking about how America might very well mess up during the nuclear age. You know, thinking of nuclear weapons in purely military terms. Right? There's a kind of interconnectedness with the historical analysis, the theoretical analysis, and present-day policy issues in this whole literature that you shouldn't lose sight of. Why is all this important? Because it defines the problem. That's what theory does. It defines the problem. It defines the question. Right? It doesn't give you answers. It's not like, oh, well, we have this theory, this Clausewitzian theory, this realist theory or whatever, and we're going to push the evidence into that framework no matter what. Some people do that, by the way. But that's not the proper function of theory. The function of theory is to define the question. Because you have this theory about what rational behavior would be, the way countries should have behaved if they were rational, and then you look at the reality and there's this huge gap between the two. It's like, yeah, they should have reached for a compromise. Very soon after the war broke out, it was clear that neither side was going to achieve a total victory, at least in the near future. The Germans had this plan, the Schlieffen Plan. Talked about this. Everyone should know what it is. The Germans were capitalizing on their ability to mobilize very quickly so that they could leave their eastern border undefended during the period when the decisive struggle is being fought in the west. Because Russia mobilizes so slowly and Germany mobilizes so fast, you can concentrate the great bulk of your forces in the west, throw them against France through neutral Belgium, because you couldn't attack France directly, because these are mountains and they're heavily fortified. Right? Instead, you have to go through the North European plain, through Belgium, into northern France, and then hopefully you'll be able to knock the French out in one great battle at the very beginning of the war. That's the hope. And there was no guarantee of success. And the Germans knew that there was no guarantee that it would succeed. And Schlieffen himself said, well, if it didn't succeed, then you have to kind of then, try to bring about a compromise peace. Right? So that's, and it didn't succeed. And you all know how, contrary to people's expectations prior to the war, about, you know, the offense being unstoppable, the offense being the dominant form of warfare, it turned out in the First World War, it was, and especially in the Western Front, it was exactly the opposite that was the case. You know, each of these great armies tried to outflank the other, and so they tried to frustrate the enemy's attempt to outflank them by moving the front further and further away from the original meeting point of the armies, until finally there were kind of a continuous front stretching from the Swiss border to the Atlantic. You know, the Germans were in occupation of large chunks of northern France, but they were unable to take Paris. And each side dug in, literally dug in, because they simply built these long lines of trenches. And then the trenches were defended with barbed wire and machine guns, and it made movement, offensive action, extremely difficult. Right? That's the basic situation on the Western Front during the First World War. Right? Stalemate, military stalemate there. Okay? That's the situation that became clear by the end of 1914. As I say, the theory would lead you to expect that, okay, we know what the situation is, we know what the true structure of power is. It means that instead of total victory, what we really need, both sides should have made this calculation, is a compromise peace, a negotiated peace. Okay? That doesn't happen. Why is that the case? Okay. And this issue is of interest also from the standpoint of contemporary international relations theory, which approaches the problem of war and peace as an informational problem. I guess the key ideas here were developed by an Australian historian named Geoffrey Blainey in a book called The Causes of War. And Blainey's argument is that wars break out because the two sides, or at least one of the two sides, has an unrealistic notion of how strong it is. It thinks it's stronger than it actually is. Right? You know, he looks at all these wars. There's a lot of optimism on both sides. But both sides, you know, it can't conform to reality. One side or the other has to be wrong. Maybe both have to be wrong about what would happen in the event of. Wars break out because both sides think that they're in a stronger position than they actually are, with the result that what war does, a war like the First World War does, is it reveals information. Contrary to what we thought about how strong we were and how we're going to win easily, it now turns out that the military balance is not nearly as favorable to us as we had thought or had hoped. That in fact there is a balance between the two sides, we should adjust our policy accordingly. Right? Rationally, the kind of political goals you strive for, the sorts of policies you pursue, should be in harmony with the existing structure of power, the real structure of power. The real structure of power had been revealed by what had happened on the battlefield. The real structure of power was one of approximate equality between the central powers, Germany and Austria, and the Entente. If you have an approximate balance of power, that suggests what sort of political settlement you should aim at. One not based on the total defeat of the adversary, but one, you know, based on a kind of compromise, negotiated peace. Okay? And those kind of Blainey arguments were taken up and formalized in a very interesting way by James Fearon, who is probably the most important international relations scholar writing in the last 20 years or so. 20 years ago, he published an extremely important article called Rationalist Explanations for War. And he basically made this kind of argument that if there were total information, you know, if people could, if everyone understood military realities in the same way, then everyone's policies would be in harmony with that one central military reality. And they would be in harmony with that, and therefore they would be kind of in harmony with each other. You wouldn't have war. Your political outcomes would be shaped by that common sense for what the balance of military power was, right? So if you had a war in a rational world, the war had to do with these informational problems. You know, so you can see the connection with the Blaney argument. And a war itself, by providing information, should clear up those problems, right? So, you know, it's an important line of argument. It suggests that what happened during the First World War, the great, you all know the story of Sherlock Holmes and the dog that didn't bark. The famous story. Sherlock Holmes was telling Dr. Watson about the significant event in a particular case. The whole problem with the barking dog, and Dr. Watson says, "But the dog didn't bark." And Sherlock Holmes says, "That was what was significant." Right? In the case of the First World War, what was significant was the failure to achieve a negotiated peace, a compromise peace, when the true military balance had become clear. You see the significance of that significant episode. You see the significance of something that did not happen only when you bring a theory to bear. Right? In this case, this whole theory about what should have happened once the true balance of military power had become clear. Right? So this whole issue is of enormous political importance. You know, why did they achieve a compromise peace once the military realities had become clear? Right? And that historical problem is important because it has all of these theoretical resonances. So what's the answer? Everyone knew that that there was there was a military stalemate. Why didn't they opt for a negotiation? Now, some people attack that problem by saying that the answer has a lot to do with regime type. You look at a regime like this German regime, not a democracy by any means. Here's Germany, a very modern country, and yet it has a political system where the emperor, where the pre-industrial elites, especially the great landowners from Eastern Germany, the Junkers, had a disproportionate amount of political power. Basically, they shaped the foreign policy of the German state. And these people, you know, they had gotten the country into the war. If they didn't achieve goals that were better than the restoration of the status quo, their whole political position within Germany, they wouldn't be able to hold on to what they had. They really needed, you know, a fundamental transformation of Germany's position in Europe. They needed something that they could not achieve through compromise. Right? And this kind of argument was linked to arguments about Germany really having caused the war. Germany caused the war because of these deformities in her foreign policies that resulted from the fact that her internal political system had these kinds of problems. Right? The most famous historian who developed arguments of this sort was named Fritz Fischer. He wrote a book The German title was Reaching for World Power. In English, the title was Germany's Aims in the First World War. It came out in the early 1960s, basically made the argument that the Germans had caused the war, although the bulk of the book was devoted not to the July crisis or the long-term origins of the war. The bulk of the book, as the English title suggests, was about Germany's political objectives as the war ran its course. And sure enough, you look at the policies that the German government pursued, you know, very ambitious policies. You know, all kinds of annexations in the West and the East, you know, designed basically to make Germany the hegemonic power in the continent of Europe. No question, right? And, you know, Fischer said, well, basically the suggestion was, if these are the policies the Germans pursued beginning very early in the war, this must have been their goal in the pre-war period as well. They're guilty for having caused the war, right? Very important argument still today for political reasons. Right. What's the problem with that argument? Well, you can't answer that question just by looking at one country. And you look at the other countries, and what's clear is that regardless of regime type, you find the same phenomenon, country after country, an escalation of war goals. You know, prior to the war, peace is very important. You're willing to kind of pull in your horns in order to preserve the peace. But once you're involved in the war, a totally different dynamic takes hold, and you see it taking hold in the Western democracies. In France, for example, you know the only one of the five European great powers that was a republic and been a democracy since, say, 1875, you find exactly the same sort of thing. I should tell you a little bit about the historiography here. That point about French policy, that was kind of buried because people wanted to play down the degree that France had annexationist goals in order to kind of pave the way for the building of European reconciliation and so on. There was actually a meeting in the early 50s between French and German historians to kind of negotiate, work out an accepted view of the origins of the First World War and the history of the 20th century. The great French historian from the interwar period who lived into the post-World War II period, Pierre Lanouvin, was a key person here, and he wrote an article about the war aims of the French government, which he basically denied that they had annexationist goals. All right, with the passage of time, those political incentives kind of fade, and people can look at these things much more honestly. There was a younger French historian, not that young, he's basically my generation now, but he wrote an important article in the mid-1960s. His name was Soutou. And he basically showed that the French had annexationist goals as well. And it basically had a code term for annexation. The code word was guarantees. We need guarantees against the renewal of German aggressiveness. And the guarantees were basically the disguised annexation of the Rhineland. Rhineland is this whole area here between Germany and the Rhine River and the west of the Rhine River, plus a certain area on the right bank of the Rhine as well. All these different things that the French intended to do in order to keep German power limited in the post-war period. And these policies were pursued on a continuous basis, Soutou was able to show, in the period of the First World War. Okay? Why, if it's not regime type, why then do these countries opt for this sort of policy? Well, there are a number of reasons that you could point to when you look at the historical record. You're asking your citizens of your country to make a really huge sacrifice. This is an extremely bloody war. For France, much worse than World War II. Right? you know, out of a population of 40 million in France, 1.3 million Frenchmen died in the war. You know, basically it's the male half of an entire generation that was essentially wiped out. If you're asking people to make that kind of sacrifice, you're going to have to offer them something real in exchange. And simply restoration of the status quo ante, that's not going to do it. Beyond that, you have this military situation where the two sides are approximately equal power. And there's a sense that the outcome of the war could tip in either direction based on marginal advantages that one side has over the other. And one of those big advantages is the ability to maintain morale. And when you begin talking in terms of a compromise peace, of something less than total victory and enshrining a peace that will enshrine all your ideals, but something a lot less than that, then it demoralizes people, makes them less willing to shed their blood. So you held back for that reason as well. You don't want to encourage defeatism the way you would if you started talking in terms of compromise. Everything had to be framed in terms of its glorious future, absolutist war aims. You find this, there's an inter-allied dynamic. You're very worried in a war of this sort that your allies are going to break, and your allies are going to make a compromise peace, a separate peace with the enemy. So in order to keep your allies in the war, you have to support your allies' annexationist goals. And your allies, for their part, they're going to support your goals. There's a famous exchange between the French Prime Minister and the Russian Tsar, where the Tsar says to the French, take Mainz, take Koblenz, you know, two German cities in the Rhineland. Go further still if you judge it useful. And the French, for their part, were willing to accept Russia's annexationist ambitions, the seizure of the Turkish Straits. So you have that dynamic feeding into this as well. Okay? So there's no compromise peace. Both sides literally dig themselves in in terms of their policies. The policies are hardened. And they reach the conclusion that there can't be a political settlement. If the war is going to end, it's going to have to end with a military victory, with a military decision, military victory of one side or the other. And so policy during the war then focuses on the two sets of factors that could result in something that's militarily decisive. One is just the way the war is fought, and you have all this emphasis placed on new tactics, that will achieve a military decision. What are these new tactics? Well, poison gas, for example, introduced in the fighting on the Western Front. The German decision to try and knock the British out of the war by destroying Britain's overseas trade, by having unrestricted submarine warfare directed against the British. The British, for their part, had been, ignoring the rules of war and blockading all shipments of food, even into Germany, even through the neutral countries on Germany's periphery, like Holland and Denmark. Crucial step that led to American intervention into the war, as we'll see. Introduction of shock troops, an important innovation in German military tactics in 1918. And then probably the most important of the tactical innovations, which was the tank. You want an answer to these trenches with the barbed wire and the machine guns and so on. Well, you have you want to fortify your offensive forces so that they can't be mowed down by enemy fire like that. You think it would have been a very simple matter, because the tank basically is the technology had been developed for agricultural purposes before the war. You know, it's the Caterpillar tractor with guns and armor. But it was very hard, given the conservatism of the militaries, to get them to introduce it. But when it was introduced, it did have a certain effect in transforming the static war of attrition in the Western Front into a war of movement by 1918. Those attempts at military decision, they essentially did not do the trick. And so the emphasis was placed on trying to get new countries to intervene in the war on your part, on your side. And so you have Italy intervene. Italy, which had been an ally of Germany's before the war, in the Triple Alliance, Italy intervenes in the war on the Allied side, basically being bribed into doing so by the Allies, promising Italy all these, annexations at the expense of Austria. Romania also intervening on the Allied side. Turkey and Bulgaria intervening on the side of the Central Powers. Right? These, certain importance, but basically these are minor countries that don't really have that much military power, no real means of generating it. Right? The truly decisive event was the intervention of the United States in the war. Why decisive? Because of the military power the United States was able to generate. America is already an extremely strong country in terms of its mobilizable war potential. The key indicator of military potential, economic potential to generate military power, was steel production. It was important in those days, given the nature of the military technology that existed at the time. You wanted to be able to produce all these guns and so on, tanks and everything. And the United States produced almost as much steel as all five of the European great powers put together by 1913. America comes in, it's going to be decisive, in part because the European powers had all kind of exhausted themselves and the American forces are totally fresh. Right? And it's clear that American power, the curve of American powers are going to continue rising while that of the Europeans is going to fall. So when the Americans come in, unless the Germans are able to knock the British out of the war with the submarine campaign, once the submarine campaign is mastered, as it was with the introduction of the convoy system, the handwriting is on the wall for the Germans. It's very clear what's going to happen. Okay. So the American intervention is decisive. And what we want to do is try and understand why it was that the United States intervened in the war. Because that whole question of why the Americans came in, this is going to give us some insight into these fundamental issues of how foreign policy is shaped. It's an important argument, revived recently by John Mearsheimer in this book I mentioned to you, The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. The argument is the Americans, they may have talked in terms of, all these liberal principles and so on, but the reality was that American policy, like the policy of any other great power, is shaped by power political considerations. America was secure only when there was a balance of power on the continent. Once there was a risk of German hegemony, a German-dominated Europe, a Germany able to mobilize the resources of all of Europe, this would pose a real threat to American security. The Americans had hoped to deal with it by passing the buck and hoping that the local great powers, Britain, France, and Russia, would be able to balance Germany on their own. But, with Russia, with a revolutionary process beginning in Russia and the threat of Russia leaving the war, with France shaken to its core by the huge blood price that the French were paying, and there were these mutinies in the French army in the early spring of 1917, the British kind of on their last legs financially. The Americans realized that they had no choice but to intervene. The American intervention was for power political reasons, to prevent Germany from emerging as the European victor, the European hegemon. Nice theory. Turns out that the evidence doesn't support it. That is not the way that the people in the Wilson government viewed things. They did not think that the Allies were on their last legs. Why'd they intervene? Well, you all know that the issue that the United States intervened over was the German decision to opt for an unrestricted submarine war against the British Isles. They were going to try and blockade the British Isles by sinking with submarines whatever merchant vessels, you know, tried to import goods into Great Britain. And the Americans said, this is a violation of our neutral rights. We cannot stand for this. We're going to intervene. Right? Now, what's important there is that those considerations count for a lot with Wilson and his top associates. And you do get the sense that absent the submarine war, absent the German decision to use those tactics, the Americans wouldn't have intervened at all. Right? Big problem for the realist theory there. On the other hand, this whole notion that the defense of neutral rights was the be-all and end-all of American policy and the Americans would intervene simply because they had to stand up for their rights, that doesn't carry any water either, because the British were violating American neutral rights left and right, you know, by, as I say, by dramatically restricting the flow of American goods into the continent, not just into Germany, but into Holland and Denmark and the neutrals that surrounded Germany. And the Americans were willing to put up with this because they didn't want to basically neutralize British naval power. They felt like, in a sense, that would be an unneutral act. You look at American policy in detail, you know, quite closely, and you get the sense that the Americans didn't quite know what they were doing. Wilson, to a certain extent, he was fed up with both sides, gave this very important speech, January of 1917. Remember that date? We intervened in the war in April 17, as well, you know, 3 months before we intervened in the war. This is the famous Peace Without Victory speech. He says, victory would mean peace forced upon the loser, a victor's terms imposed upon the vanquished. It would be accepted in humiliation, under duress, at an intolerable sacrifice, and would leave a sting, a resentment, a bitter memory upon which terms of peace would rest, not permanently, but only as upon quicksand. Only a peace between equals can last. Only a peace, the very principle of which is equality and a common participation in a common benefit. The right state of mind, the right feeling between nations is as necessary for lasting peace as is the just settlement of vexed questions of territory or of racial and national allegiance. Right? Peace among equals. Compromise peace. Peace without victory. That's the way to go. But as soon as the United States goes into the war, all these notions of peace without victory is like thrown into the trash bin. Now, Germany has, you'll see this when you read those Wilson speeches, Germany has to be defeated totally. Germany is a criminal country, right? You got to punish the criminal. You can't make a deal with the criminal. All right. The core issue that we have to grapple with when we look at Wilson, both today and next time, is what are we to make of that fundamental approach to policymaking? It's a central tradition in American policy. Right? This whole notion that you can't just think in terms of power. You can't take an amoral approach to policy. Policy had to be based on principles. What we are as a nation. We stand up for what's right. We stand up for justice. Right? Very much the Wilsonian tradition. This whole notion of compromise. You can't compromise with evil. You know, peace based on interest rather than what's right and wrong. That's not the way to go. It's in that context that Kennan lecture that you're reading this week is of such fundamental importance. You know, when I was your age and I was exposed to it, I remember just being totally overwhelmed by it because it was a fundamentally different way of looking at international politics from the way that I had kind of absorbed. You know, what is Kennan's approach? He's very critical of Wilson. He thinks that the Wilson policy was just poison. That it led directly to instability in the world. You want to understand, you know, why you had a Second World War just 20 years after the First World War? Well, a big part of the answer has to do not with the fact that Wilson was defeated, but the fact that Wilson was successful. Right? We'll see. That's my argument. We'll see that argument. Kennan says this Wilson policy was destructive of the peace. And then he says, well, you may say, well, what should we have done? And he lays out very clearly the alternative policy that he says the United States should have pursued. The policy, it's like, you have to, basically, say the Americans should have realized that the balance of power of Europe was of fundamental importance to us, that our whole security rested on the existence of a balance of power in Europe. And given its importance, we should have been involved a lot earlier than we were in trying to shore up a stable structure of power in Europe where no single power could dominate the continent. And to do that, we would have had to build up a certain military establishment so people would pay attention to what we said. You know, this whole notion of military power should be an integral part of the conduct of foreign policy in peace as well as in war. And you should have refrained from all this blackening of the enemy as the total embodiment of evil, and you should have, thought much more in terms of how do you go about ending the war, bringing about a compromise, because your goal is not simply to defeat the adversary, but to create a stable structure of power for the indefinite future. Right? And he says that was the way to go. And then he said, well, why didn't the Americans go that route? And he says, it's not just Wilson's fault or the fault of his tough collaborators. It's the fault of the American people as a whole. We have this ideology that prevents us from pursuing an intelligent foreign policy. And again, he's thinking of the nuclear age, of the post-1945 world, when he's saying these things. And he has that remarkable passage at the very end where he says, if we explain these things away, if we excuse our political failures by alluding to the sacred quality of our own political institutions, we can easily end up excusing ourselves into total failure, meaning a Third World War, general nuclear war, right? Very, very important line of argument. You know, we will be coming back to these issues, I promise you, over and over again. Anyway, the Americans intervene. They adopt a program of fighting the war to the bitter end, to totally crushing Germany. And given American power, and given people's sense for the way that power is going to be developed, the Germans finally decide, without actually withdrawing to German territory proper, to sue for peace. And an agreement is worked out in November of 1918 for an armistice for the Germans to lay down their arms and retreat to their territory, but in such a way that it would make it impossible for them to renew the military struggle. But the peace is based on an agreement where both sides agreed that the ultimate peace would be based on certain principles, the principles of the Wilsonian. Okay, so that's the end of the First World War story. The next story is what happened then? What kind of peace was fashioned? And what does it tell? What does that story tell us about the basic issues we're concerned with? Okay, thank you.